Chapter 16. The daily rituals of Yankee Stadium vary slightly when the team is out of town. Without the urgency of crowds and cameras, and without the expectation of another pristine playing surface, the old house creaks slowly to life, so that by late morning the groundskeepers in their khaki shorts and ash t-shirts are tending the field at a languid pace. Grantley, the chief grass cutter, tinkers with a spider-like Toro mower, while Tommy, the clay specialist, packs and levels the dirt behind home plate. Dan pushes a smaller mower across the thick bluegrass along the first baseline. Sprinklers erupt at orchestrated intervals around the outfield warning track. A tour guide huddles with a group behind the third base dugout and points to something in the distance, beyond the scoreboard. The 57,000 seats are empty. Sounds echo softly around the place. The muffled engine of a small mower, the laughter of a groundskeeper, the distant hissing of a spray washer cleaning seats in the upper deck, the four train rumbling by just beyond the right field wall, the pecking of a hammer near the press box. For those who maintained the house that Ruth built, the off days are cherished, wedged between the nostalgia of Yankee greatness and the promise of more to come. Some 25 years after he was expected to arrive, Ron Williamson stepped up from the bench in the Yankee dugout and onto the brown, crushed-shell warning track that borders the field. He paused to take in the enormity of the stadium, to soak in the atmosphere of baseball's holiest shrine. It was a brilliantly blue, clear spring day. The air was light, the sun was high, the grass so flat and green it could have been a fine carpet. The sun warmed his pale skin. The smell of freshly cut grass reminded him of other fields, other games, old dreams. He was wearing a Yankee cap, a souvenir from the front office, and because he was a celebrity at the moment in New York for a segment on Good Morning America with Diane Sawyer, he was wearing his only sport coat, the navy blazer Annette had hurriedly purchased 2 weeks earlier, and his only tie and pair of slacks. The shoes had changed, though. He'd lost interest in clothes. Though he'd once worked in a haberdashery and offered ready opinions about what others wore, he didn't care now. 12 years of prison garb does that to you. Under the cap was a bowl-cut mess of bright gray hair, thick and disheveled. Ron was now 46, but looked much older. He adjusted the cap, then stepped onto the grass. He was 6 feet tall, and though his body showed the damage of 20 years of abuse and neglect, there were still hints of the great athlete. He strolled across foul territory, stepped over the dirt base path, and headed for the mound, where he stood for a moment and gazed up at the endless rows of bright blue seats. He gently put his foot on the rubber, then shook his head. Don Larson had pitched the perfect game from this exact spot. Whitey Ford, one of his idols, had owned this mound. He looked over his left shoulder, out to right field, where the wall seemed too close, where Roger Maris had placed so many fly balls just far enough to clear the fence. And far away in deep center, beyond the wall, he could see the monuments of the greatest Yankees. Mickey was out there. Mark Barrett stood at home plate, also wearing a Yankee cap, and wondered what his client was thinking. Release a man from prison where he'd spent 12 years for nothing, with no apologies because no one has the guts to admit wrongdoing, no farewells, just get the hell out of here and please go as quietly as possible. No compensation, counseling, letter from the governor or any other official, no citation for public service. 2 weeks later, he's in the midst of a media storm, and everybody wants a piece of him. Remarkably, Ron was holding no grudges. He and Dennis were too busy soaking up the richness of their emancipation. The grudges would come later, long after the media went away.